Welcome to Maury's podcast series, Speaking of Changing Legal, where we discuss the leading trends and innovations reshaping the way legal work is done. This episode features Maury's David Malkinson, who interviews special guest Tara Waters, a widely respected lawyer and expert on legal technology, process, and adoption.
Hi there, and welcome to the podcast. I'm David Malkinson, and today we're going to be talking about the state of play of generative AI within law firms, where we're at today, best practices for gaining adoption, how to really extract value for it, and really what to look out for over the coming years. Now, I'm really, really chuffed today to have as our guest Tara Waters. And Tara, we first encountered each other at an AI conference back in 2019, December 2019. Little did we know what was ahead of us. And you know, I was really struck by what you had to say that day, but also the sort of the completeness of the thinking around it, not only over the technology, but also how to actually use it to make an actual meaningful impact to the firm. So fast forward to today, it looks like many of your predictions are playing out. So we're going to go through some of that today. But before we dive into that, can you share a bit about your career journey and what you're focusing on today?
Yeah, thank you. And yeah, really scary to hear past predictions come to light, but hopefully they weren't too wild and crazy. So hi, yeah, I'm Tara Waters. I have been working in the legal industry for about 15 years, but this is actually my second career. I spent my first 7 years of my professional career in technology. So I'm the rare person that moved from tech into law rather than the other direction. And certainly when I started getting involved in the legal innovation side of the legal industry, I was one of very few people that have that background. There's probably a lot more people now working within firms that come from the tech industry because law has suddenly become an interesting place to work, which is fantastic to have happen. It's not just for lawyers anymore. But I have been a practicing lawyer for the past 15 years, working in various law firms, primarily based in the UK, and probably for the past 7-ish years, shifted over into the more operational and innovation side as well. So I've made that transition and have been really focused on ultimately the challenge of digital transformation in law firms, doing that both on small scale and big scale ways. And in my last role, which was a law firm called Ashurst, I was able to set our digital strategy and become the chief digital officer of the firm, which is the first time we had a role like that, and was working for a few years trying to implement different capabilities into the firm, ultimately trying to deliver digital capabilities for business outcomes. And of course, over the past 2 years, Gen AI was a huge part of that. So me and my team, actually the last initiative that I worked on before I ended up leaving the firm at the end of the UK summer, was delivering an enterprise-wide legal Gen AI platform into the firm. We did that holistically, globally, all at once, over 4,500 people on Gen AI. And that was really a fantastic feat to have done as my last big contribution to the firm. And now I have stuck out on my own and working with a number of different organizations on broader digital transformation as well as Gen AI specific activities.
That's great. I mean, what a 360. Technologist to practicing lawyer to innovation to into the C-suite and then rolling out that scale of AI across an international 4,000 seat organization. That's truly impressive. Okay, your former self is about to come back and haunt you, Tara. So we believe applied NLP will transform the practice of law over the coming decade. So now we're 5 years in, we're exactly at the halfway point of that decade. How close are we, do you think, to that vision? And what's the one thing that sort of surprised you about the adoption of AI in law firms in the past 12 to 24 months?
Yeah, I mean, I'm impressed, very prescient of us back then. But to be honest, I think certainly, you know, the core team within Ashurst that has been looking at the technology space for the practice of law and the business of law, we genuinely believed that. You know, our view was we had seen a lot of fantastic ML-based AI systems come through and help us shift the gears in terms of what we could deliver for our clients and meet the challenges that they were throwing at us. But we had always were of the view that next stage of AI was somewhere on the precipice and we weren't quite there yet. And you know, some of the challenge of adoption of AI tools with lawyers was that they just weren't so easy to use, and they didn't quite do everything that was expected of an AI solution. And I think that point around, you know, NLP, and here we are, you know, nearly at the 2-year anniversary of ChatGPT entering everyone's lives. I think it's that usability that really shifted the game. And I would love to say that back in 2019, I was on top of what was happening in terms of transformers and LLMs, but honestly, I wasn't. But the creation of an application that was just so very intuitive and easy to use, and you could use your natural language and ask it a question in a very Google-esque way, although notwithstanding, simply Googling is not the best way to use LLMs. You do have to give it a bit more context and instruction. That's what changed the game. That's why suddenly everyone said, we need this technology in our businesses, and I'm going to start using this technology in my everyday life because it was so simple to use. And I think that's really been the game change. It's a technology now that when we look at the AI, the Gen AI specific solutions, including those built for legal, those are tools that are designed to put immediately in lawyers and other people's hands to use intuitively without a huge amount of technical knowledge or training. They're not things that only sit in the hands of innovation teams or technology teams within firms. And that's, I think, the real phase change of what's happened here.
And you've got as good an experience as anybody that I know of really colliding this technology with the reality of practicing lawyer. Another one here for you, another quote from your lawyers expect perfection. This is my notes. Terribly written down. Lawyers expect perfection, 99% accuracy rate, dash, only will be good enough for lawyer, which you might know. So, you know, obviously you got the hallucinations. At scale, 4,000 users is a lot. Is the mindset shifted to sort of accept maybe not a lack of accuracy? How does that play out across different sort of personas across the firm?
Yeah, I think, you know, key to the Gen AI adoption has been shifting those mindsets. And I think they have shifted with Gen AI because it's been so out there publicly, the limitations, the challenge of hallucinations, the very, very well-known stories of lawyers specifically using the technology in the wrong way and not actually checking. And I think fortunately though, what that's served as an educational piece and not a deterrent yet. So we very much were focused on the user experience, not just the lawyer experience, because we were looking to roll it out globally, so also to the business services side of the firm. But we very much thought about what those people were going to think, that high bar of expectation. And there's an enormous still expectations, reality gap between what these LLM-based tools can do and what people want them to do. They want it to be magic. They want it to get everything right. But they also then now have heard the stories that it doesn't. And so what was really key in terms of rolling that out and adopting was shifting the mindset and making it really clear. These are tools that we're putting in your hand not to perform magic and whip up and invent a final perfect product. You are not going to get that final product. But what this will do is help you create that first draft or first bit of something. It'll help you organize and structure your thoughts better, and it will progress you. So it's fantastic to help progress you in your work, but do not expect it to produce the final thing. And this is really key. This is a tool to assist you with doing your work more efficiently, with higher quality, with better accuracy, but it's there only as an assistant to you doing your job. And I think we were fortunately pretty successful in getting that message across by being very transparent about the limitations and making sure that people were really clear on what we had discovered the tools were good at doing, what we had discovered the tools were not good at doing, and also getting all the users to share their stories. And I think that was really important. And again, it wasn't just a one-way message. It was actually cross-firm messaging where people said, hey, I tried to do this. It didn't do it well. And so then everyone was forewarned. Or someone might say, I tried to do this. It didn't do it well. But someone piped in and said, yes, I tried to do something similar, but here's how I got through it. And here I found another way to get what I was looking for. So it became an educational experience for everyone. And in a way we have not seen happen with law firms in particular and lawyers in particular, everyone suddenly became a little bit more open to that trial and error experience, where with other tools, I think maybe just the way they were marketed to the lawyers, there was an expectation that they didn't need the trial and error. And therefore, as soon as the error hit, you know, they kind of were like, well, I don't trust this anymore. And now I'm switching off. Whereas we very much had to be intentional in adopting and introducing Gen AI tools that said there's errors here. We know that there are, and you need to help us understand and find the ways through it. And let's all learn about this together. And the lawyers have actually shifted and opened their minds a bit more than they had been previously, which is fantastic. You have to capitalize on that willingness to actually shift that mindset forward a little bit, which, you know, as I said, that we didn't experience that with a lot of other platforms. And so this has been really fantastic, I think.
Yeah, that is great. And you know, you did it across such a scale. Were there any particular use cases, just high-level use cases or personas where the tools took root very quickly? What are the sort of the early sort of obvious success stories?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the sort of initial observations that we had, and you know, we played back internally to everyone, including the leadership, was first of all, because we did roll it out globally, we saw an immediate and faster uptake with the business services side of the business. And I expect that's in part because those people had a little bit more space in their days to do some of the trial and error versus the lawyers who, you know, are always under time pressure. So it was great actually to see how quickly we saw business services take up what was a legal specific tool. So it really proved out our hypothesis that notwithstanding we had selected a tool that was designed for the legal industry and to do legal work, that it had much broader application. And it really validated our decision to go firm wide. And, you know, we saw in particular people in business development and bids using it very heavily, really trying to find ways for them to be much more efficient in their work, synthesizing information and trying to get it out and disseminate it as quickly as possible. Because when you're responding to RFPs and things like that, there's a lot of moving pieces. Oftentimes, you know, they're cross firm and cross practice responses that need to go through, and being able to work through all that material quickly is really important. So that was really great. We definitely saw in the sort of practice support, the practice executive secretary type roles, we saw a lot of adoption around just basic communication. How could they respond and write better emails? How could they interpret, you know, partner instructions a bit better to understand what they were looking to do? So it was really helping them on a very individualized level to do their work better and to feel a bit more confident in their work as well, which I you know, I thought was really fantastic to see. And then on the legal side, I think it, you know, I guess a little bit of a slower uptake, but still an enormous uptake. And again, a lot of experimentation in the early stages. So not everyone immediately started using it on their matters, of course, because it required them to get a bit comfortable with using the tool. But certainly in the sort of first couple of months, we saw so much experimentation. So we saw a lot of people, you know, just testing the limits of what it could do. And ultimately, I think in my perspective, I think gaining that confidence and skill, making them feel like, okay, I understand how to use this better. I've had to play around with it. I've uploaded a few documents to see what it can do, to get them to the place where they would be able and feel more confident in using it for the client work. And, you know, certainly throughout this sort of trial and pilot that we did before the rollout, people were, you know, using it in particular, I think, to absorb as much information as possible and get that into a form that they was usable in some additional way. So whether that's, you know, new regulation or new legislation or updates and things like that, that they wanted to, you know, synthesize and get the five key bullet points that they need to know, rather than spend hours and hours and hours digesting that, they could get to that information really quickly. And then they could decide, okay, now I can move on and do the next thing, which might be drafting something that goes to a client or preparing their own analyses or something like that. So definitely really helping people take bigger chunks of work and synthesizing that down into more bite-sized things that, again, progress them a little bit forward in terms of what they needed to do next.
Yeah, and you'll never in those use cases, you'll never be able to replace just reading the document from top to bottom. But getting you off the springboard is really, 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 really useful. I use it myself all of the time.
Yeah. And being able to point you to, okay, here's the 10 key points from this large document. Now I can actually go target sections of the document to deep dive into and make sure I really understand.
Yeah. So in terms of the overall timescale for the adoption of these firms, I remember we talked last time, you said it should take a lot longer than you would expect in order to gain true adoption and really extract value out of it. How do you think about that in terms of the overall timescale of rolling the software out?
Yeah, I think for me, definitely, having been in this space where we've done so many tech implementations of different scales over the past several years, one of my biggest learnings was the unreasonable expectations we placed on ourselves, frankly, to get value out of these tools, and to have some form of quantifiable ROI, those magic three letters, to play back and say this was a success or this was not a success. And I think what I definitely learned was that you need much more than a few months. The adoption will not be instantaneous. We have to keep in mind that, and especially with Gen AI, we're asking a group of people who have full-time day jobs and on the lawyer side are working sometimes double-digit hours on a regular basis to try to take up a new tool and not just take it up, but actually learn how to use it well before they really are able to apply it to gain those time efficiencies. That's asking a lot of people. And you can't just say, hey, here it is, get going, and then wait 3 months and be like, people aren't quite using it as much as we thought. Well, we must have made an error in judgment. I think that is just being way too unreasonable in terms of what you can expect your people to be doing and what you can expect you to be able to measure. So I think really the key thing is that, in my experience now, I think you need a minimum of 12 to 18 months of time once you've rolled something out fully to your user base. So if it's global, to the whole user base, or if it's to a smaller group, to that defined user base, you're going to need a minimum of 12 months of measurement from that point. So if it takes you a few months to roll something out, because you might do it staged or phased, then your clock only starts once it's in every single person's hands that you wanted it to be in. And then I think you need a full 12 months of measurement, because you're going to see peaks and valleys. And also, you need to be pushing the adoption throughout that period. You don't just hand something over and then just start measuring things, but you don't do anything further in terms of intervention and support. You need to be out there constantly reminding people it's there, reminding them to get on it, and actually looking to see who's not on it, and then making those interventions to try to encourage people to get on it. So my view is you need a full 12 months of measurement to really have any sense of, is this actually heading in the right direction? And I don't think at the end of that 12 months is this was a success or not a success, and this is a yes or a no. It's now we have enough data to actually start understanding, are we heading in the right direction? And can we get it, if the adoption isn't quite where you want it to be, can we get it to where we want to be with the right activities and support and change management? Or is it looking like maybe, we need to make some adjustments and we want to, give ourselves another 12 months, but maybe we target a core group of people where we see that they're really using it and getting value, and we start to cut around the fringes and say, okay, it seems like these groups of people really don't understand. You have to make that decision that says, actually, no, we want everyone using it, or actually, we're happy with a smaller group of people using it, and you can start making those decisions. So from my perspective, it's, from launch, a 12 to 18 month period, probably at a minimum, just to say, I have enough information to start making new decisions. And so, my view is people should be thinking about, an initial 2 year contract before you actually start thinking about changing things. And I think that will shift probably the dynamic of how, vendors and law firms might start approaching their arrangements. But I really do think that extended period of time is necessary. The other thing, just to finally wrap up on that point, is I think also people need to appreciate that if you're bringing on a new solution and it's not a mandated solution, it's not, core tech stack, it's not a, Microsoft product, it's not your time recording software that everyone has to use, you're not going to get 100% adoption. Like, that is actually an unreasonable expectation. And I do think sometimes you get those glass half empty people sometimes and are like, oh, well, that wasn't a success. And you're like, 60% is actually 3 to 4 times the average adoption of any SaaS solution in the world. So, and then you're going into legal and you're saying, this is on top of your day job. I want you to try to learn to adopt this tool. 60%, 50%, even 40%, 30% is higher than the average rate. And so I think being a bit clearer with stakeholders around what the level should look like and, you know, what that trajectory and curve should look like over time is going to become, you know, really important if it's not something you're already doing. Managing the expectations and helping them to see that actually, frankly, anything over 20-25% is hugely successful.
Yeah, I mean, we need more voices like that out in the market, because it's impossible to disagree with you. But it's a brave software vendor that sits in front of a CFO or a head of innovation and goes, yeah, it'd be 12 to 18 months before you can really know whether this thing I'm going to sell you is of value. But that's the reality of it. This, as you say, people don't need it to actually complete their job, but there is downward pressure to do it. I mean, is there do you see downward pressure from clients to be using these tools? We certainly hear part of the conversation when we look at the corporate side all of the conversation on the corporate side is that law firms can be doing and should be doing things more efficiently using these tools, although they can't quite put to point exactly to reasons why. Is that something that you see from your clients?
Yeah, I think as a general proposition, right, you know, for more than a decade, that downward pressure from clients around using technology to work more efficiently to help improve, you know, the pricing, frankly, of matters for clients, that's been there for quite a long period of time. I think there are work streams now, types of work like due diligence, large scale, you know, contract reviews, repapering exercises, where a firm actually probably cannot deliver that without some form of technology, particularly AI-based technology. And that's pretty much par for the course now. I think with Gen AI, I don't think we're at a place yet where clients are mandating the use of Gen AI. And I think that's for a few reasons. One, again, I think there's only a handful of tools that are market ready from an enterprise law firm perspective. So I don't think that we're mature enough yet in the reliability of the tools to actually have anyone say, you must use platform X to do this work. As I said, you know, lawyers are still learning how to use them in the best way. They're not going to deploy them wholesale on a client matter at this point in time. I think it's highly unlikely, unless they've actually built something very bespoke for a certain type of client work, which a few firms, you know, have done, to be honest. So there may be some doing that in pockets. It's definitely not something that any law firm can say, oh, I've procured this Gen AI tool, now we're using it everywhere in our firm. So I don't think a client's going to expect that to happen. Yeah. I think they're still expecting, you know, cost savings. And certainly if you look at all the research that has been conducted since, you know, 2 years ago, that's definitely at a high level. A client expectation is your fees will be going down, and we expect probably because you're using more AI and Gen AI tools. But I think if you actually talk to the clients, and I've been attending a lot of conferences where the client voice is there, I don't think they're expecting everyone to immediately be deploying this on their matters, but they are expecting and hoping for, and probably not getting as much of this, is more conversations around how to leverage this technology if the law firm has brought it in a win-win way, because the clients are still concerned about their own data and the way things are being used. So they are still a bit hesitant sometimes around the use even. So they're not going to mandate it when they're not quite sure they want their client data to be in these tools in the first place. But what they're looking for are more in-depth conversations of, okay, how can we use this to work together to improve the way we work, to improve our pricing, etc. And I think that's the real opportunity for law firms. And I think if people are having challenges within the firm of getting some of the buy-in around, you know, the client need, I think identifying those really forward-thinking clients that are saying, like, come and talk to me and let's figure it out and let's do some, we'll start with something initially and then let's see how we can grow it. You can doing that in partnership with your client, that's a fantastic way to sell that proposition within to the firm.
Yeah, we've actually brokered a number of those conversations, and you're absolutely right. Once you're in the same room solving a problem together, it's incredibly impactful. You mentioned that some clients, we certainly see this, some clients are just not only resistant, they flat out refuse to allow law firms to use any sort of generative AI because it's good, because some are still cloud averse, very, very few these days. But was that a consideration in terms of adoption, to just to sort of put some sort of ethical wall type thing around, so to say this client, you cannot upload this into any generative AI tool? And what are sort of the guardrails, or did it sort of self-police itself?
No, I mean, that was obviously a huge concern and consideration as we were going through the entire kind of exploration process. And we worked very, very closely with General Counsel's Office, Risk and Compliance, Data Info Security, et cetera, to really think about, one, how do we identify whether this is an issue for clients or not? Two, what are our actual contractual obligations? Let's actually go through and look and see what do our standard terms say? But we've got a lot of clients that are on non-standard terms. What do those terms say? And how do we put in place sufficient mitigations to the risks that, you know, data is used in a way that is not permitted, or, you know, there's, you know, accidental uploading of data from a client, et cetera. And we spent a lot of time designing mitigations that importantly didn't disrupt our ability to really push our people to use the technology as much as possible. So, and I think we benefited, you know, the timing of our rollout was, you know, UK summer 2024. So just this year. So I think we've reached the point where many more clients were expecting these types of announcements from their law firms versus a year prior, where I think clients probably were a lot more hesitant because they hadn't had many law firms jumping on that bandwagon yet. And they themselves probably hadn't seen too many tools to feel comfortable with how it might be used. So I think with the passage of time, more clients have gotten comfortable. Mm-hmm. But absolutely, you know, there are clients that either, you know, have very clear and unambiguous conditions in the contractual arrangements with their firms, where, you know, you might have to go get express consent before you can use anything or agree specific tools. And so we spent a lot of time working through each of that on a client by client basis to make sure we were really clear on the universe where there were concerns. But our approach was definitely more of, we need to make this as open as possible to give our people the confidence to use it. Because I think if we went out scaremongering, like, okay, here's all the things we want to avoid doing, then you are going to have a lot of hesitation. It wasn't going to encourage the usage and adoption. So it was a careful balancing act. And it took, you know, a lot of conversations and discussions around the best way to approach it. But certainly, I think from our perspective, we managed to strike that balance. We made sure we were very clear where there were potential restrictions or limitations. But we also were very clear that outside of those limited use cases, or limited cases, I should say, that we really wanted people on the tool, testing and trialing it out and doing what they could. And obviously, if they had any concerns, they could talk to any one of us within the sort of cross-functional team that helped roll it out to address anything from that perspective. And ultimately, what we had after we announced the launch publicly were, you know, dozens and dozens of positive conversations with clients who were really excited to have the opportunity to learn from our experience. And I think the fact that we went public and said, we've done this and we've actually done this in a really robust way, they wanted to hear how we got there and use that to help inform their own journeys, which was fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. Paradoxically, just touching on the point you make about client terms and analyzing each one, what a great use case for generative AI that is, just to those data and those terms, which brings us on, you know, the client requirements for the law firm to be more efficient. That's sort of the whole deal, isn't it? To be able to do things quicker and more efficiently. And this is a topic which has been discussed so frequently, but yet very, very inconclusively, because I think nobody knows the answer. And that's the impact on fee arrangements and the billable hour. And we see from our side, we do spend assessments on the corporate side, and we see a big, big increase on actually the use of AI to look across invoices and legal spend. But how do you see that? Is it changing today that much? How do you see that truly impacting how these fee arrangements will work in the long term? I hear lots of these tools and experiments are sort of being given away as value add, which doesn't feel particularly sustainable to me. So just wondering how you think about how that might pan out.
Yeah, so I would be very surprised if there are many clients and law firms who have seen a direct impact yet of Gen AI on the current billing and fee arrangements. I'm very, very bullish on this technology, but I think that it will be a little bit of a slow burn in terms of seeing the actual flow on impact into fees, into chargeable models, into law firm models, until, again, we actually have the ability to measure what the efficiency and value and ROI actually looks like. So, and also I think, and from talking to many people around the world in the legal innovation space and people that are working and trying to bring Gen AI into their work, I think that we don't know yet, you know, what the measurable impact is. We haven't done those measurements because, again, most of us are still in there in year one or year two of actually having Gen AI available to them. Mm-hmm. So I expect it'll be, you know, my viewpoint, I think it'll be much more medium term until we see any real specific change that mm-hmm. is caused by the introduction of Gen AI into the workflow. But I think also there's been a lot of anecdotal evidence that using Gen AI is, again, helping to tackle aspects and parts of the workday. As I said, creating efficiency, shifting people forward a bit faster, certain elements of the work that they're doing. But where we've talked to law firms who are using Gen AI for client work, the feedback that I'm hearing is what that ultimately means is not that they spend less time on the matter itself, but they're shifting where their focus is. So less focus on things that can be done faster with the technology, more focus on things that require lots of time and thought and expertise and conversation. So the overall time being spent on matters is not necessarily being drastically changed yet, even where they are genuinely trying to leverage Gen AI. It's just the mix of the type of work where that time is being allocated is shifting to the higher value stuff and the more complex stuff. So I think it'll be a while before we can see the proper trends and patterns of how that plays out. But if people are spending a lot more time on the higher value things and doing things that they maybe would have rushed through or not done at all or as at a more in-depth level, because they had to do so much more of the manual work, means that actually, you know, hypothetically, it could mean fees increase because actually it's the partner doing the hard thinking, doesn't have to bother itself with all this other stuff because that's being done much more efficiently. Now, in the reality, I don't think fees are actually going to increase ultimately, but what we'll see then is probably a reset of what we think, you know, fees should actually look like and what is the value of legal work. I think that's going to be the exciting question. What is the value of the legal work that the lawyers are providing when Gen AI is part of the package?
Yeah, and increasingly as just the practice of law becomes just naturally ever more complex, it will meet that challenge without having to just continually upgrade fees and make things more expensive. So I agree with you. It won't change quickly, but it will iteratively and sort of use case by use case as the technology improves. I'm going to ask you to do some predictions again. So and we'll meet again in 5 years and see how good they are. So who do you think will be the winners in the losers, both on the software vendor side and on the law firm side?
So I definitely could not possibly be specific from that perspective, but I actually think it is absolutely too soon to tell. I don't know if the big vendors right now, you know, the biggest players in the space right now will be the biggest players in 5 years from now, because I think the market is moving really quickly. My predictions on the vendor side are definitely, and we've already started seeing this, I think we're going to see a lot of M&A activity. I think we're going to see a lot of consolidation. And I think some of the legacy, quote unquote, legal tech tools, I think that they potentially have some existential threat in front of them. What we don't need in the industry is for every single existing tech vendor adding Gen AI somewhere in their platform and then asking their firms to suddenly be supporting 20 platforms that basically all have the same capability. So I expect and predict a lot of consolidation. And I think there are going to be some losers, unfortunately. I think there are going to be some types of platforms that are really niche and focused and single point solution based that cease to have a place anymore because that will be wrapped up in another tool that kind of encompasses a bit more. I think we've seen a divergence of strategy so far, and we'll see whether this plays out well, of, you know, some of the bigger players trying to really cover as much of the Gen AI spectrum as possible versus more niche players that are targeting specific types of work or practice areas. And same with traditional legal tech, I think there's room for both. I don't think any law firm's going to want a single provider for everything, just in the same way we haven't wanted one for anything so far. But I think we are interested in a concentrated number of vendors that really have high quality offerings. And I think the winners will be the ones that focus a lot on the user experience, the workflows, and really, you know, doing their best to support how lawyers work and really bring their platform to where the lawyers like to work, and make sure that they are creating experiences that feel really natural and seamless and intuitive and easy to adopt. So that's my prediction at a much higher level, probably than anyone would hope, I'd say. But I just, you couldn't name anybody and say what you think is going to happen.
But that was the heart of the question, is what aspects of those software vendors, and I think you got it right. And you mentioned on our conversation last time, it's really those vendors that can mimic the chain of thought of a practicing lawyer in the workflows of the products. Those are the ones today that seem to be working out well. And it's actually amazing how quickly one vendor can catch up with another with this technology. So I think it's all to play for in this space. And I couldn't agree with you more. People just shoehorning LLMs into their product and with questionable value is confusing for me as a vendor that tries to say, okay, there's this Venn diagram of all this software, which sort of all do the same things. To try and differentiate one from the other is not easy. Okay, final question. What's the sort of one advice point that you would give to a law firm who are looking to lean into generative AI in 2025? What's the one thing that you would tell them?
I would tell them to be bold. Actually, I think, you know, certainly all of my discussions around the industry, I think people have felt very cautious. And one of the things that, you know, my team did really well was we decided to be bold. We made those decisions. We did that with all of the information at our fingertips. And that allowed us then to plan an implementation that we could really execute on and execute quickly. I think we ultimately, end to end, it was an 8-month period between, you know, trialing some solutions, selecting one, and getting to that global rollout stage. That is lightning speed for law and law firms. Yeah. And in terms of actually making the investment decision and rolling out, it was actually only 4 months. That's crazy. And that's not necessarily the pace at which any of us want to work on a regular basis. But I think what we showed was that it can be done with the right mix of people, with the right planning, with the right forethought around governance and how to connect with your user base in a way that gets them to that mindset shift, which is really important. So I think law firms in particular should be bold. They should think that they can do this. And I absolutely appreciate the need to do trials and pilots and consider the best way to do it for your firm. So by all means, please make sure that you are reacting to the way your firm will best receive what you're trying to do. But I also think that this is a time period where the people in law firms will never be more interested in technology than now. And so people really need to strike while the iron is hot. And I think that a little bit more confidence in yourself, in your ability to deliver this is needed. And I would love to see more of these bold stories. And I love when I hear them on LinkedIn, I'm celebrating. I absolutely love seeing some of the law firms taking the big leaps, making the big investments, moving quickly, you know, being first movers, being willing to do that is fantastic.
Great. So just before we wrap up, I'd love you to tell our listeners a bit more about yourself, what you're currently working on, and how they can get in touch with you or learn more, Tara.
Yes, thank you. Well, so I have struck out on my own and I've got two exciting projects. One is Innovation Esquire. It's a content brand that I launched actually a few years ago, more in a personal blog style. I've turned that into more of a professional content brand. I've got a website, Innovation esq.com. And I'm putting out monthly issues with articles and digital art that are focused on what's happening in the legal industry, both from an innovation perspective, but both from the perspective of having been a practicing lawyer for the past 15 years. And I've been getting great feedback. I've also got swag on that site that people can buy. I'm known for having stickers and mugs and t-shirts and things like that for my projects and for my team when we did things, because it was just fun. So I'm making some of that available now for people to buy if they're interested in. Absolutely no pressure from that perspective. And then now professionally, now that I'm out of law firm life, I've started my own consulting business, and I've already started working with a handful of organizations to help them. Not just a lot of work is focused on Gen AI, but also more broadly around digital transformation. I think this is a space where everyone is, still trying to figure out their paths and or get themselves back on track in terms of pushing forward, and really excited to be able to help more people across the industry now and have a broader impact, which is really exciting for me. And, now I can hopefully help everyone else be a bit more bold.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you, Tara. That was fantastic to hear your stories, your honesty, your experience. It really bled through in this. So thank you very much for joining us, Tara. Thank you for listening to the Moray Podcast. And until next time, thank you.